This country is at war with Germany.
Hallo zusammen und damit herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge Wunder, Wissen, Weltkrieg. Mein Name ist Raffaella Höfner. In diesem Podcast spreche ich mit ehemaligen Soldaten, mit US-Veteranen, mit Überlebenden und Opfern des Zweiten Weltkriegs. Hört aus erster Hand die Erlebnisse, die Schrecken und Wunder, die meine Gäste selbst erlebt haben. Hier geht es um den Tatort Zweiter Weltkrieg. Ein Podcast gegen das Vergessen und für den Frieden. April 1945. Schönewalde. Ruhe. Verdächtige Ruhe. Vor mir fliegen die B-17-Bomber der 303. Bombergruppe. Ihr Ziel ist das SS-Feldzugdepot bei Oranienburg. Ihre Mission klingt einfach und ist doch so schwer. Ihre Bomben müssen gezielt fallen und alles zerstören, was sich dort befindet. Sie sind die erste Welle. Die zweite steht bereits in den Startlöchern. Wir sind bald da, Joe. Gibt mir mein Staffelkamerad Captain Richard Tracy über Funk durch. Er fliegt rechts von mir. Unsere Aufgabe ist es, unseren Bombern Begleitschutz zu geben. Die Jungs können loslegen. Da vorne ist es. Gebe ich zurück. Ohrenbetäubender Lärm lässt mich herumfahren. Fuck, höre ich Tracy fluchen. Deutsche, pass auf, Joe, deutsche Düsenjäger. Schüsse peitschen an meiner Maschine vorbei, zischen durch die Luft, treffen einige unserer Bomber. Ich drehe sofort ab und versuche, hinter die Messerschmitt zu gelangen. Im Augenwinkel sehe ich, dass Tracy ebenfalls vom Kurs abkommt. Die kriegen wir, stößt er atemlos hervor. Tracy ist ein brillanter Flieger und ich weiß, dass es Gold wert ist, ihn in meinen Reihen zu wissen. Ich feuere. Einmal, zweimal. Es bringt nichts, wird loszuschießen. Was hat mein Ausbilder immer gesagt? Schieß nicht dahin, wo die Maschine ist. Schieß dahin, wo sie sein wird. Ich ziele ein wenig höher und weiter nach vorne. Ein lauter Knall, Volltreffer. Der Deutsche ist ein erfahrener Pilot. Das sehe ich sofort daran, wie er die Kontrolle über seine Maschine behält. Eine Sekunde später lenkt er seine Messerschmitt in den Wolkenschleier. »Ich kann ihn nicht mehr sehen, Joe«, ruft mir Tracy zu. »Ich hole ihn mir.« Auch ich steuere mein Flugzeug nach oben und zwinge es durch den Wolkenschleier. Meine Nerven sind wie Geigensaiten gespannt. Meine Sinne geschärft wie ein Degen. Wo ist er? Da. Das Flugzeug taucht aus den Wolken auf wie ein Geist. Die Messerschmitt. Mit einem rasanten Manöver bringe ich meine Maschine in halbrechte Position. Sie schert dazu von oben herab wie ein Fahrstuhl. Stoppt die Fallbewegung und stoppt dann wie eine Eins. Die Höhe hier ist ungemütlich und lebensbedrohlich zugleich. Wenn einer von uns beiden abspringen muss, bleibt kaum Zeit, dass sich der Fallschirm öffnet. Für diese Erkenntnis brauche ich mein Höhenmesser nicht. Die Landschaft unter mir ist so nah, dass ich mit Anstrengung die Grashalme zählen könnte. Ein schnelles Wackeln der Tragflächen, dann kippt die Messerschmitt leicht seitlich nach unten. Noch tiefer. Ich entscheide innerhalb von einer Millisekunde und komme sofort mit. In gestrecktem Sturz rasen wir dem Boden entgegen. Der deutsche Flieger muss seine Maschine ganz genau kennen. Hinter ihm bauschen sich blassschwarze Rauchschweife auf. Der Fahrtwind pfeift um meine Kabine. Gleich werden wir auf der Erde zerschellen. Der Deutsche zischt mit atemberaubender Geschwindigkeit wieder nach oben. Ich tue es ihm nach und bete, dass es nicht zu spät ist. Stöhnend bäumt sich mein Flugzeug auf und lässt sich wieder nach oben lenken. Ich darf die Messerschmitt auf keinen Fall hinter mich lassen. In weiter Entfernung sehe ich Flugzeuge. Ich kann nicht sagen, ob sie zu uns oder zum Feind gehören. Wie ein Mückenschwarm fliegen sie träge über den Horizont. Keiner von den Piloten weiß, was sich hier gerade bei mir abspielt. Kleine Dörfer wandern unter mir vorbei. Der Deutsche geht in die Kurve. Die rechte Tragfläche der Messerschmitt zeigt senkrecht zur Erde. Unten verläuft eine kleine Straße durch grünes Weideland. Ich schere aus der Kehrkurve heraus auf die linke Position. Jetzt ist der Deutsche direkt vor mir. Ich denke nicht, sondern handle nur. Mein rechter Daumen verharrt auf dem schwarzen Knopf der Kanonenauslösung. Wir haben die Sonne im Rücken. Das heißt, nach vorne ist freie Sicht. Der Deutsche muss eine Wendung riskieren, wenn er nicht von hinten getroffen werden will. Er zieht nach links. Ich bleibe ihm auf den Fersen. Da. Die Sonne spiegelt sich in seiner Windschutzscheibe. Jetzt drücke ich ab. Ein Volltreffer. Schwarzer Rauch färbt den Himmel. Die Messerschmitt bleibt noch auf Kurs. Der Pilot steuert sie noch weiter nach oben. Donnerwetter. Dann stürzt sie wie ein toter Vogel abwärts. Wie aus dem Nichts fliegt ein Körper an mir vorbei. Der Fallschirm öffnet sich in Sekunden, gerade noch rechtzeitig. Wie eine Qualle im Meer schwebt der Pilot durch die Wolken. Die Messerschmitt jagt den gestreckten Sturz der Landschaft entgegen. In wenigen Augenblicken wird sie zerschellen. Mit einem ohrenbetäubenden Knall schlägt sie ein und explodiert. Eine Feuerwolke steigt nach oben. Ich werde den Piloten nicht beschießen. Er schwebt wie eine Feder nach unten. Es sieht beinahe friedlich aus. Das Duell in den Wolken ist gewonnen. Diesmal bin ich als Sieger hervorgegangen. Erst jetzt bemerke ich, wie der Schweiß meine Kleidung durchtränkt hat. Ich hole tief Luft und lenke meine Maschine dann weiter nach oben. Jetzt heißt es, so schnell wie möglich zurück zum Flugplatz zu kommen. In der heutigen Folge spreche ich mit Joe Peterbus. Joe wurde am 25. November 1924 in St. Paul, Minnesota geboren, wuchs jedoch vor dem Hintergrund der Weltwirtschaftskrise hauptsächlich in Wisconsin auf. Er stammt aus einer Familie mit militärischer Tradition. Sein Vater wandert 1906 aus Deutschland in die Vereinigten Staaten aus, tritt im selben Jahr in die Armee ein und absolviert seinen Auslandsdienst auf den Philippinen und kämpft im Ersten Weltkrieg. Joe wächst in einer sehr großen Familie auf. Er und seine Brüder tun alles, was sie können, um die Familie in den mageren Jahren der Depression zu unterstützen, und sie alle dienen später beim Militär. Als kleiner Junge besucht Joe eine katholische Schule und möchte Priester werden. Er geht sogar ins Priesterseminar. Joe ist in den ersten Kriegsjahren dort, als aber die Japaner am 7. Dezember 1941 Pearl Harbor angreifen, entscheidet er sich, sich freiwillig zu melden. Zuerst versucht er es bei der Marine, aber Joe entscheidet sich schließlich für das Army Air Corps und wurde zum Flugkadett. An seinem 18. Geburtstag wird er vereidigt und hofft, ein Ritter der Lüfte zu werden. Joe beginnt eine Ausbildung und wird als Pilotanwärter ausgewählt, wo er die Kurse dann auch besteht, während er von einem Feld zum nächsten wechselt. Er verdient sich seine Flügel und ist Ende 1944 bereit, nach Übersee verschifft zu werden. Zu diesem Zeitpunkt beginnt Joe mit Flugmissionen in seiner P-51 Mustang, die er Josephine nennt. Seine Hauptaufgabe besteht darin, die eigenen Bomber zu eskortieren und zu schützen. Aber er fliegt auch Bodenunterstützungsmissionen auf der Suche nach Gelegenheitszielen. Am 10. April 1945 erlebt Joe einen seiner denkwürdigsten Kriegstage. Er nimmt es mit einem deutschen Düsenjäger, einer Messerschmitt, in einem Luftkampf auf und es gelingt ihm, das Flugzeug abzuschießen. Später am selben Tag wird Joe getroffen und auch er muss abspringen. Joe wird gefangen genommen und in Stalag 11 geschickt, aber im Chaos des Jahres 45 in Deutschland gelingt ihm schließlich die Flucht und er kann sich für kurze Zeit mit den russischen Streitkräften verbinden und mit ihnen gegen die Deutschen kämpfen. Zu diesem Zeitpunkt befindet sich der Krieg in seinen letzten Tagen und Joe kann sich wieder den amerikanischen Streitkräften anschließen. Ich durfte Joe über Zoom interviewen und stehe bis heute mit ihm in Kontakt. Hört jetzt rein ins Interview, um Joes Geschichte aus erster Hand erfahren zu können. Achtung, das nachfolgende Interview in dieser Folge ist auf Englisch. Good to see you.
Yeah.
Okay. I just read your script you sent me about you being a pilot.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm familiar. I spent seven years in Germany.
Okay. Where have you been?
In fact, my son went to University of Maryland in Munich.
Okay. So where do you live right now? You live in California?
Yes, suburb of Sacramento. It's Roseville, pretty big town, but... I retired in Colorado Springs.
I have family there. It's really nice. I really like Colorado Springs.
Oh, yeah. I retired there in 79, and then my wife passed in 05, and I moved out to California to be with my grandson and his family and my two great granddaughters.
Yeah.
At the time, I was they were just babies, and I had to learn how to change diapers again and all that sort of stuff but it kept me going.
Yeah.
Hanging around with young people is better than sitting around telling old stories about the past.
Yeah, that's true.
Regardless of your age, you have to look forward to the future.
Yeah.
Right.
See, well, could you give me a brief biography of yourself, where you have been born and...
Okay. Well, I was born on the 25th of November of 1924 in St. Paul, Minnesota. And we lived there until I was about 3 years old. And then we moved. This, of course, is during the Depression. It was just before the Depression. So about 3, 4 years old, and we moved to Wisconsin. And I grew most of my life was, my early days were spent in Wisconsin. I went to school there in the Holy Assumption. And I was had an affinity to become a priest. And in 1939, I went to the seminary at St. Nazian's, Wisconsin, run by the Salutatorian Fathers, which is a German order. And anyway, I was getting ready to be a priest and doing my study and everything, and then Pearl Harbor came along, and so I decided. I come from a military family. My brothers were in, and my father had spent days in the Philippines during this 1909, chased Pancho Villa along the Mexican border and things like that. Anyway, I had made my decision. I was 17 at the time, so I tried to get into the Navy, and that they were taking at 17, and I didn't pass the eye exam. So on my 18th birthday, I took an exam to get into the Army Air Corps. And I passed it, and I started my training and did a lot of rigorous training in aircraft and all sorts of things. And finally, at 19 years old, I graduated and fighter pilot, second lieutenant fighter pilot.
How did the training look like? What did you have to do there?
Where?
How did the training camp look like? What?
Well, my basic training, like the march and all that sort of getting up early. Well, that was simple for me because I've been in the seminary. It was a full day up at 5:30, the mass, the breakfast, everything was arranged. So it was sort of a breeze for me. But anyway, the basic training was on Miami Beach.
Okay. Could be worse.
And our barracks was one of the big hotels that was converted into, I think it was the Fontainebleau, a big luxury hotel. So my basic training was fairly simple. And, from there, I went through some ground school, learning about the aerodynamics and this sort of thing, and eventually started flying in 1943 in the primary trainer, which was the Stearman, the PT-7B, which is a bi-wing. It's like one of the old World War One aircraft, open cockpit and that sort of thing. And so I got 65 hours in it, and then went to another, a higher quality aircraft, the PT-13, and then finally ended up in the AT-6, the Advanced Trainer 6. And it's called the Texan. And I finished that and graduated on the 15th of April of 1940. At 19 years old, that's the second. And then we went to replacement training unit where we were flying the actual fighter aircraft that we were going to be using overseas. And I did that at Fort Myers, Florida, and flying the P-40. And got about 200 hours in it, and then was shipped to England, took the Ile de France, which was a French luxury liner that was converted to a troop ship, and went to Scotland, landed in Scotland on about 6th November 1944, and then from there I went down to Peterborough, England, which is about 90 miles north of London. And joined a group that was flying the P-51D Mustangs. And then I started my combat training. I mean, my combat. We had already had, I had a lot of time in the P-40, and the P-51 was not that much a jump. So I got about 10 hours in the P-51 and started flying combat.
How many people did fit in the plane?
All in one.
Oh, you just were just the single pilot.
A fighter pilot. I saw fighter in little cockpit, and my longest mission was 7 hours and 20 minutes strapped in.
Wow, that's a long time.
So anyway, our missions were primarily escorting the bombers, and then then there were also fighter sweeps where we go and hit targets of opportunity, and then we have interdiction targets that we do that we go. But it was mostly escorting the bombers, checking the Luftwaffe. So I had a lot of experience, really exciting and fruitful missions. I flew 49 missions and 267 hours of combat time. And my last mission, the 49th, I was escorting some 400 some odd bombers to Oranienburg, just north of Berlin. And we were escorting about 400 some bombers with about a couple of hundred fighters. And we got to Oranienburg, and as we were over Oranienburg, the only problem was flak. We had heavy flak. And then when the bombers dropped their bombs, then we got hit by a swarm of Messerschmitt 362s, the turbojet. And I was flying high cover, so I saw the 362 blow up one B-17, and I rolled over and started after him. And just as he blew up the second B-17, I got him in the right, left wing, and it ended up causing some damage. And then he started down to the deck disappeared into some clouds. So I didn't know what happened there. And then I went over and started strafing a bunch of aircraft at an airfield at Schoenwalde. And at Schoenwalde, I got hit. I was by myself, and I got hit quite a bit. The last one, I just blew up an FW-200, the Condor, and I was coming off target, and I got some bad hits in the aircraft. Anyway, it was engine was smoking and stuff. I got up to 10,000 feet and made it from Oranienburg area Magdeburg. Actually, I was headed toward Magdeburg. That's where the Allies and the Wehrmacht were fighting. And I got to Bern, which is about 20, 25 miles away from Magdeburg, and I was down to 1,000 feet. So I thought that the aircraft was burning, so do I have to bail out? But as I was going to bail out, I got hit by an F-7190. I was burning, I was able to turn into him just as it fired its rockets, and fortunately he missed. By that time, I was down to about 500 feet, and so I had to bail out. I had to bail out the left side because the right side was burning, and I bailed out at about 350 feet. They hit the tail with my knee, and the air opened the chute, parachute, and opened and swung once and hit the ground.
Could you describe? Could you describe your feelings when you were sitting in the plane and you saw like it's smoking and you losing control over the plane?
Your training has a lot to do with it, but anyway, I just took it as a game and did what I thought was right. It just was following my instincts all along, and I do remember when I was going over the side, I thought, darn it, my mom's going to get a telegram about this, and she's going to be, worried sick, and because I had lost my brother, he was in the Navy, and he was torpedoed, and he was killed a year before. Anyway, that's what I remember going through my mind. The others was just automatically coming, in milliseconds, making decisions. I hit the ground and I was captured and was POW and put into a little cell at Berg Airfield for 2 days. And there I was questioned by Gestapo, nothing physical, just intense questions. And then both nights I was there, the RAF was bombing the airfield, and so I sat in the bomb shelter with all the Germans around me, bombs falling out. I don't think I was a very popular person. Anyway, it was. And then on the 13th of April, this all occurred on the 10th of April, mentioned that, but the 45. So I went down to they took me by rail down to Stalag 11, which was about an hour and a half hour rail ride, and then it was a British POW camp, and all the Brits had left, evacuating to the east. And there were about 100 of the British soldiers left, and myself, and then we were put on a forced march back to the Berlin area. During the march, it was just pandemonium. There were thousands of refugees going east, thousands going west, and army units going east, and army units trying to get to the front, west, and then we were strafed by fighters at the same time. And it was just pandemonium. It was just really, really, everything was out of control. And the German soldiers were on motorcycles going up and down the line trying to get some semblance of order out of chaos. But anyway, ended up at Luckenwalde. And at Luckenwalde, which is just outside of Berlin, just shortly, just by the edge of Berlin. I don't know if you're familiar with it. But anyway, that was, and it was mostly Russian prisoners. So I spent about a week there and then escaped. And as I was I was going east towards the Russians. They were fighting in Berlin, so I was going towards Berlin. And as I was out about 5 miles from camp,
how were you able to escape the camp?
It was very, this is near the end of the war. And the security was very, very lax. It was basically, you just couldn't walk out. Camp, you had to. I mean, there were some guards around and stuff. So at night, I went under the fence and was able to make it out.
Okay.
So it was it was not a big deal with the escaping. But I did. I did remove myself from the camp without their permission. So.
You could call that escaping.
Yeah. Right. So anyway, then this Russian tank unit, and I was able to communicate with the little German I knew and the little English the Russian knew, and he could understand German too. So it did a lot of sign language. And anyway, he said, hop on. And so I hopped on the tank, and they were going to Wittenberg on the Elbe. That was their target. So we went through Jüterbog and then Jüterbog to Wittenberg on the Elbe. That's about probably 7 or 8 days with them fighting a little few skirmishes, but you know, was not what I'm used to as a pilot. You know, I was not close to all this, you know, the death and everything that was involved, but now I was. I saw how hard it was for the troops. So I made it to, at Wittenberg, there was still some skirmishes going on, but not very. And an American patrol crossed the Elbe, and there we're talking to the Russians, and the Russians released me to them, and then I went with them and went on a few trips, and eventually ended up back in Paris and repatriated, and then sent home on the 1st, and made it home on the 1st of June to New York.
Do you remember your very first mission you had to do for the army?
Very first mission.
Yes. Do you remember that?
Well, yeah, it was basically a normal mission. There was no really excitement. Now you got to remember, I was 19 years old and 20 years old, and you know, when you're 19 years old, the male species think they're going to live forever, and you know, I was never worried about anything. It's an excitement. It was an adventure. The whole war to me was one big adventure, and a 7-month adventure, and so it was. One of the missions. I think it was my third or fourth mission, as we were escorting 1,000 or so bombers, and we were hit by about 200 to 300 Luftwaffe, 109s and 190s. It was just, you know, just a complete dogfights going on from 30,000 feet all the way down to the deck, and bombers blowing up, engines, and parachutes. I was more worried about hitting some debris than I was shooting down a 109. And I had a head-on pass with a 190, and they were coming like this. And he was firing, and I was firing. I saw a couple hits on his wing, but nothing significant, and then we passed about 50 feet apart, we're probably about closing speed of probably 800 miles an hour. I knew I was doing at least 400. I'm sure he was doing at least 400. so that sort of thing, yeah. That was accelerating.
When you got hit, can you remember how you jumped out the plane? Did you get injured by landing with a parachute, or what?
Well, I got some burns. I had some burns on my arms, my leg, and then I hit hard. So I didn't sprain them, but I hit hard on my back, and I had a bad back. But it wasn't enough to, you know, put me out of commission. I could still maneuver. I landed in the middle of a large farmer's field, and there were, you know, hundreds of acres all around me, no place to hide or escape. So.
And who caught you? Were the, like, German soldiers or civilians?
Well, when I landed, I got up, looked around, and then I saw about 10, you know, it's spring, April, and the farm workers were out on the farm, and they came running at me at about, they were about probably 50 yards away and started running after me. I'm sure they were going to do me in. And as they got about 20 yards from me, I heard this noise behind me. I looked around, and there was a Luftwaffe sergeant in a motorcycle. He come tearing up, stopped, and the civilians were continuing to run and pulled out his Luger and fired a couple shots in the air and stopped him. And then simultaneously, some of the big Buckley Bucks from the town, the Bürgermeister and the chief of police, and they came out and stopped the sergeant, and they wanted me to take me into town to interrogate me. Well, they did, and we were doing some tense interrogation, and the chief of police really bad. He was ready to shoot me on the spot. Arguments going on and this sort of thing. And then the crowd was gathering outside, and the sergeant said, "Oh, we're going to go." So he takes me on his motorcycle and goes back to the airport at Berg, and that's where the rest of my journey starts.
Could you describe the Russian soldiers? Because I heard that the German soldiers were really, really scared to get captured by the Russians.
Oh, yeah. When I was with the Russians, as soon as the German, particularly the mothers, found out that there was an American in the crowd, they sought me out, and they wanted me to stay with them and their daughters and this sort of stuff. I stayed with them, and they were safe for that night anyway from rape and pillage. But it was one night that, and they were definitely afraid. The Russians, they were a different lot. They were really rough. I went into on a patrol with Russian patrol. About six or seven men and myself. And it was at Juniberg. And there was an apartment complex. It was really nice. It was, a square with a nice green area in the center of the square. And we were going through the apartments, and this the sergeant that was leading the patrol, he gets into the tussing and yelling and screaming, and he says he would get to one apartment that's really furnished nice, and it's nice audio equipment, nice furniture. And he tells us to get aside, and he gets in the middle of the room with a burp gun, and he just sprays pens in a circle, spraying it and laughing and cussing and all that. And I'm thinking, well, what did I get myself into here? And anyway, that was one of the incidents that I had. And their vehicles, I noticed that their vehicles were not cared for. I can't say this is all of the Russian army or anything, but the group that I was with, the trucks, the gears were burnt out, they were going along at slow speeds, and this. And then we had one, we stopped at one farmhouse, and the kills, they slaughtered a bunch of cattle and ducks and stuff like that. Must have been a 30, 40 foot table they made, and they're all set around it, and there was vodka and meat and duck and all that. And there was every five minutes there was a toast, And I don't think I've never been that drunk in my life.
That's so cliched, right? The Russians and the vodka.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've heard of I heard of another veteran. He experienced the end of the war as well as you did at the Elbe River, and he told me that all the German soldiers jumped into the Elbe River to swim over to the Americans, though they won't surrender to the Russians.
Yeah.
Did you experience those scenes as well? When did you experience some scenes as well when you were at the Elbe River? Like Germans going over the river to...
We were pretty well close. And I don't know what it was. They were sort of overprotecting me. They were sort of retaining me. At this time, the Potsdam Conference was going on, and there was a lot of tension building between the Russians and the Allies, this sort of stuff about how the end of the war is going to be managed. And I don't know if I was being sort of held as some kind of a hostage or what. The American sergeant really had to talk to the lieutenant. They were really hard, fierce, and then they finally let me go.
Did you experience a personal miracle during your time at war? Where you say, like, oh, that's a miracle I made it, or that's a miracle I survived?
Oh, yeah, yeah. My whole period over there, and not only there, but throughout my career, has just been a miracle. So many, believe it or not, things that, the war, there were other incidents too, missions that came back from that the weather was just completely, and I had to make really some dangerous decisions to eventually land, going down where I could have hit a building or whatever, and then Korea and. Other in Vietnam, and many, many, many pressures with death. And I feel that God was with me. I did not lose my dedications to God, and I'm willing to. Die for my God, my country, and my family, or my family and my country. God damn country.
Yeah. You told me that you had an older brother. What happened to him?
Well, during World War II, my brother was the machinist mate, first class, the master machinist sub chaser, and he was on escort duty for the convoys that were going over. And of course, the German Navy's submarine force, their packs, they were interdicting the convoys, and that's what happened to him. He was there were 180 on the ship he was on, and they got torpedoed don't have it off my head, but I was able to find out what submarine hit the ship. And in 2003, when I was researching it, the captain of that ship is still alive. And so I was able to trace that. But in any event, he was a machine. I'm sure he was down in the engine room. And of the 180 on board the ship, there were only 60 that survived. So they all the rest were killed. And then my oldest brother, he was in the army, and he was in the invasion of southern France in 1942. So it was just shortly after the main invasion of Normandy. And he went through all that, and then he stayed in the army of occupation. He and his wife, they adopted a little German boy, and Paul. And then when he finally did go home. It was about 1949. He came back to state. Then Korea started, and he immediately was sent over to Korea. And on the 2nd of November, 1950, he was killed in action. He was up in North Korea, and that's when the Chinese came over the border, and he was killed there.
Okay.
So.
And you told me that he adopted a German boy?
Yeah,
How did that happen?
Well, they were stationed in Germany.
Yeah.
And it was in the 40s, it was right after the war, and there were a lot of, you know, orphans. They could not have children. They adopted them.
Is he still lived in America now with you guys?
No, he passed away some time ago.
Okay.
So.
If you could describe this war in like a few words, which words would you choose?
Oh, epic! You know, it was. You know, there's so. What do you think? You know, people don't have no idea nowadays what war is all about. You know, that type of a war. So, I mean, you're talking. You know, there are just as many people, if not more people, killed in Dresden than there were in Hiroshima. Is atomic with the living with all these the gore and sorrow, everything that goes on. Anyway, it was 55 million deaths.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the entire population of France. Every man, woman, child.
Such a big number. You can't even imagine how many people this is.
Yeah, yeah. And to go on, you know, I eventually found out 60 years later that the 262 that I shot down, I hit, was Oberleutnant Walter Schuck, a top German ace with 206 aerial victories. He had shot down 206 aircraft.
That's crazy.
He was a top German ace. He was on Der Spiegel and all the other magazines during the war. And he received the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross and the Iron Cross. In 1960, we met in Vista, California for the second time, the first time being in the air battle, and then the second day. And he told me that when he went into the clouds, he made a turn thinking I was going to follow him into the clouds and he would lose me. And as he made that turn, his engine disintegrated. He had to bail out with great difficulty. And he always... And we became very, very close friends. We spent over the last, from 2005 until he passed away in 2015, 10 years as great friends. I went to Germany several times, and we both went to England a couple of times together. And then he was over here about three, four times. We went to air shows and stuff like that.
That's really cool. You met in the air and you were shooting at him and he tried to escape. And so you met after the war again.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
Yeah. So he was really a gentleman. And we got along real well.
Yeah.
He was stationed up in northern Finland at the along the Izmir, and there he was interdicting the traffic and the fighting with the Russian Air Force in the Murmansk area. He was at Potsdam in northern station at Bertano.
How did you get in contact with him? How did you find him?
Well, the other people find, there's a Norwegian author, a prolific author who was writing books, and he was working on Walter's autobiography, and they had been trying ever since the war. In 2002, that our contact, and I through another source, which is another, believe it or not, the way it all came about was there was a 13-year-old boy at Berg laying in the ditch watching the air battles go on above him and seeing all the action. And he saw this B-51, he saw this 190, and he saw this burning B-51, and this 190 trying to shoot him down, and the pilot bailing out, and the crowd, and the farmers trying to capture him. He saw all what I just told you. He saw all that. He was there. He was one of the crowd. So Berg is East Germany, and it wasn't until, of course, reunification that they were able to open up and start doing things. And the TV stations in the Berg area were doing specials on recovering World War II aircraft. Werner, the kid's name was Werner Dietrich, and so he went to the producers and said, "Hey, I know I saw this." And he told them the story and saw them, those were there. So they got out there with their big metal detectors and backhoes, and they excavated by aircraft. It was about 10 feet under the ground.
This was your aircraft?
My aircraft, yeah.
What?
Yeah, and I bought a lot of the parts of it. And anyway, this was in 1995 or early 1996 or late 1995 that they did the special where they recovered. So for a good year, he was trying to find out who the pilot of that was through research. He was contacting the United States Air Force Archives. And he finally got a break, and he contacted a guy from my old unit, and he said, "Yeah, well, that sounds like Peterburg." He was there. And so anyway, I get this letter in 97, and he tells the story. And I knew him. I said, "Well, everything is said, that's my aircraft." So then, a few weeks later, I get a call from a producer and said, "Hey, they want to do a follow-on. I want to bring you to Germany and do a follow-on on the special we have on recovery." And my wife had a stroke in 96, and I was about to leave her. And so he said, "Well, it's okay if we come and visit you." So the whole TV crew and Werner, they all came over to Colorado Springs and brought parts of my aircraft. Can you see that?
Yes.
That's the cylinder. That's the cylinder of my aircraft. And I've got some other parts up there. And this is the scarf I wore on all my neck.
Was it the war battle when you jumped out the plane with your parachute?
Pardon?
Was it the fight in the air when you jumped out with a parachute? Or was it another fight when you...
When I jumped out, I was, you know, I was burning, and there was nobody, there was no other aircraft around.
Okay, so you had more fights, you had to jump out the aircraft.
Pardon?
The 13-year-old watched you fight the German guy, the German pilot? Was it this one where you got, like, on fire when you had to jump out the parachute?
Yeah.
Oh, this was this sweet, oh, crazy. And they found the
Yeah, the that's what I'm saying, that this is a briefer than that. This kid saw this air battle, and then through all the, you know, the Cold War period and everything until reunification, he comes out and gets somebody to excavate these pieces of equipment for my aircraft.
That's unbelievable.
Well,
that's crazy. Do you still have contact with this guy who was 13 by this time? Do you still have contact to the kid who was 13 and watched your fight?
No, he passed away. Yeah, we were in close contact. He did not have a computer, so
yeah.
It was all stale mail. So it was 10 days for my letter to get to him and 10 days to get back and give the answer and all that sort of stuff. But he passed away about, about 2012, something like that.
Yeah.
Between 10 and 12.
Well, and, that's insane.
But he's got a museum. I should have brought all my pictures up, and you would have been able to see. I have got pictures of him doing with the backhoe, digging their pieces out. And then most of the parts he kept, and they were in a museum. He made a museum in one of his farm.
Yeah.
And so we had my propeller and a lot of those.
How was it to meet the German pilot the first time? What did you guys meet
time? See, this is where it goes on now. See, they came over to Colorado. And during the session, we're talking. I'm telling him the story. Well, he thought I was part of a battle over Magdeburg. And I wasn't. I was in Oranienburg, and I had made it all the way back to Bern when I bailed out. And I told him the story about the 262 and getting some hits at him and him disappearing into the clouds and stuff. And then they spent about 4 or 5 days in Colorado Springs. Took him up to the Pikes Peak.
Yes.
They went by the car. They didn't walk. And then took him over to the Air Force Academy and had a great time. But then when we left, Werner says, "I'm going to find that 262 pilot." I said, "Well, good luck." So about a month later, I get a letter from him. "Eureka, I found him. It's Walter Schuch." Well, I didn't take that. I say, oh, it's a fog of war and all that sort of stuff. I said, I'll take 50%, maybe. Yeah, maybe yes, maybe no. And then I just went along with that for quite a while. And then there were some other people. Some people were wanting to contact me because I was a researcher. Mario Schultz was a researcher from Oranienburg who was doing a history of that great that of April of Adams. And so let me say the last my train of thought. There was a lot of other things going on. But anyway, sometime in 2002, I get this email from the Swedish author, Krister Bergström, who is writing Walter's biography. So he says, "I understand," and he sends me email, so he's got computers. So he sends me emails saying, "Hey, I understand you wrote a description of your last mission shortly after the war when it was all fresh in your mind. You mind sending me that?" I said, "Yeah, sure." So I sent it to him. And about 3 days later, I got a message back. He says, "Absolutely, positively, you're the one that shot down Walter Schuch." He said that all your time, everything is exact. You know, everything, his really not knowing each other or anything about each other, his description of the mission is exactly like mine. I said, well, okay, I'll say maybe 98, 99%, but there's still, you know, I can't. He said, yes, we can. He said, because you say that you, in your report, you say that you saw him shoot down two BC-17s in a row. He is the only one that did that. He is the only one on that mission that shot down two aircraft in a row. In fact, he shot down four aircraft B-17s in a row. Two of them was before he hit another box of bombers. Then after he shot those down, he came over to my box. That's what I saw. And so it had to be me. I was eyewitness to his shoot downs. And that's the 262 that I shot up. So that's the way it came about.
And where did you meet the first time?
In Vista, California, on the 15th. The 18th of May of 2005 at the old Bowl Pilots meeting in Vista, California.
How was it like to meet him after all those years?
Oh, it was awesome. Yeah, it was really great. You know, he's one of the top, 10% of the Luftwaffe aces, number of hits. You know, it's sort of a different thing with pilot. It's not the person you're after the aircraft, and it's a, you know, it's like the knights of old, the duel. You know, respect each other and everything.
Yeah.
The best man wins. You know, so that's how it sort of really. Yeah. Our last get together, Walter and I, we went to Wendover, England. To sign some prints. Aviation prints is a big thing, you know, there's that's a big business. So anyway, we were both over there, invited over there, signed some prints. And while we were there, Vera Lynn, who is a British singer, one of the most popular singers of the war, out of England. And Walter really loved her music and singing. He got to meet her, and he was, they were up at Potsamo, which is way away from all the stuff going on in the lower part of Europe, they were a bunch of ne'er-do-well pilots, jaunty, young kid. Walter was 4 years older than I, he was 24, and they were having a lot of fun up there. They played jazz and all that sort of stuff and listened to whatever radio they wanted to listen to. it was a pretty good.
Sounds like pretty good time and friendship.
Yeah.
What happened with you after the war? Did you stay first in Germany or did you go back to the States?
Well, I went back to the States on the 13th of June in 1945, I married my fiance, Josephine, who I had named my aircraft in. And I had to get my mom's permission to get married because I hadn't turned 21 yet. So and then, anyway, I went into administrative. 21, I was made commander of a 400-man black unit. You know, we were segregated during that time, and I was the only white person in that unit. It was all African American. So, and then in 1947, this was in 1946, I took command, and then in 1947, Truman desegregated the armed forces. So it was my responsibility to integrate my unit into the white units, which was an extremely difficult job. It was very, very complicated in several areas. And then the main thing was to make sure that that once our guys got into the white units, they weren't abused. So anyway, then in June of 47, I was promoted to captain, and I was 22 years old.
That's still so young.
Yeah, and then I had administrative jobs, and then I went into accounting and disbursing. I was a finance officer, you know, in charge of I was at Shepherd Air Force Base in Texas, and then I was the accounting and disbursing officer for the unit for the base. That you're talking about, you know, 450 at that time was. In 1947, $450 million payroll sort of thing. And let me say 450 now, 4.5 payroll. And we go to the bank and count the money and all that, you know, guys. It was that sort of thing. And then in November of 1950, Korea came along, and then it was sent over to Korea. So then I had my flying B-51s again in Korea, but doing a different type of work. So support, you know, hitting targets on the ground, troops in contact. I whether some of these terms sink in, or you know what they mean, or whatever. But troops in contact is when two opposing forces would be in contact with each other, firing at each other, and they want air support. The friend support, the forces I'm supporting, want us to come down and blow up these guys over here. See, that's coup in contact. So that's what a lot of them. And then bombing artillery units at this. And I had one mission. I was coming off target, and I got a bullet right through the prop as I was coming off target. The aircraft was shaking, and made it back to the base, and stuck the engine down and saw the big hole in the prop. And then I was doing napalm and rocket. Had a flight that we were going in there, and did a good napalm run. They were enemy troops in trenches along a mountain, a ridge. So we went in and dropped the napalm, and then they came around and did the rocket run. And rocket run, you had to be really straight, you know, to get the rocket, because there's no guidance or anything to the rocket. It's just, it'll go where the aircraft is. So you had to be so. So I get a bullet through the wing root, and up through, blows up the canopy, and then hits the armor plating behind my head. I reach up, and my hand's full of blood from my face, bleeding profusely. So I pull off target and call my wingman. My wingman lost his radio, so I can't talk to him. So the procedure is to wobble your wings, and he knows that I want him to come and join us. He came and joined me, and I called the tower. We were only about 35, 40 minutes away from the whole of the base. So I had called them and said I've been hit, and I don't know how bad it is. So the wingman, not knowing that anything that I was, what my problem was, we get to the base, and then he pulls off in front of me and goes and lands, and all the beat wagons and fire engines and stuff like that waiting for me to come down and land, they all chased him down the runway. So I land, I taxi back to my revetment, my parking area, and I'm down in the cockpit getting my maps and stuff. My crew chief is up on the wing waiting for a debrief, and so I go up, and he throws up his hand and slips off the wing to almost hurt himself. And anyway, he was so shocked by the way my face looked, full of blood, that he almost got more damage than I did. Anyway, it was all the plexiglass. It just, you know, blew the plexiglass. It does, and plexiglass throughout my face. So spent about 3 or 4 hours with the flight surgeon picking out plexiglass. I flew flying another couple of days later.
That's crazy. You had a lot of war experience. That's for sure.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to the young generation or to young people with looking back at all your experience?
Well, this is extremely difficult because I feel I'm living in a different universe. You know, at 5 years old, I was working during the Depression. I mean, I was going out with my brother Paul, and we were junking, picking up rags, bottles, and iron, and stuff like that, selling it to help support the family. And my dad was working, night work. My mother, of course, we had seven kids, and her time was occupied. So all of this stuff that people have now, this quality time, and stuff around, comfy and nice, that didn't come up in my brain. It was, you went out, you did it, you knew you had to do the best you could in order to survive. And that's what basically, do the best you can and to your own self, be true, look in the mirror once a while and evaluate yourself, make sure that you're, other people can help. 90% of it is up to you. So, don't wait for the rest of the world to take care of.
What happened with you after the Korea War? Did you go to another one, or did you just retire from wars now?
No, I did a lot of, after Korea I got back and I was, I sat under an atomic bomb in 1954. They had blowing up by testing atomic bombs during that period, and they had the one to see what that kind of damage it would do. And anyway, I volunteered for the test. I went out to Las Vegas, what they called that desert rock. I sat in a trench, it's about 7 feet deep, and about 100 yards away, there was a big tower, and on top of it was a 20 kiloton atomic bomb size that blew up Hiroshima. And the thing went off, and we were in trenches, and I had never seen it. It was just an experience that sounded, felt like all the marrow in my bones, about sound, like you're exploding and stuff. Although you had no real physical, it was just the atmosphere. And then after about 30 minutes, we rousted us out of the trenches and went up to ground zero and walked around our ground zero with people around taking, with the ranking counters, measuring our rank and intent and that sort of stuff. And then shortly after, about those 6 or 8 minutes after that, I had transitioned into jets, and I was flying a jet on a weather reconnaissance for a mission. We would be flying missions, and we had to know what the weather was, and so we'd complete the mission. We fly that, and I got up to about 18,000 feet. I was flying a jet, and I got a light, a red light showing I had a fire in the plenum chamber. And I pulled the throttle back to stop the fuel going in the engine. And I called and I started, turned around and started back. And by the time I turned around and started my letdown, the red light had flickered off. And then I came back on solid. And then I stopped, cocked the throttle, which shut off everything to the engine. And the light was still on, so I had to bail out. So I had eject. And what ejection is, I don't know if you're familiar with it, an ejection out of an aircraft. You're setting, at that time, it was all manual. You're setting out a 37-millimeter cannon shell, and you pull up this armrest, the seat, and you pull one trigger, and it blows the canopy off, and then you pull the other trigger, and you and the strap to the seat are thrown out, are blown out of the air. Well, as you're blown out of the aircraft, you're tumbling. And so what you have to do is you have to release yourself from the seat. Okay?
Oh, so you have terrific. To sit down.
You have to go and release yourself. So you pull your seatbelt and open that, and then you're thrown clear of the seat. But you have to figure out how close am I to the seat, because it's tumbling right alongside you behind you. And so then you wait a significant or whatever you think, and you pull the ripcord, and hopefully the parachute doesn't get entangled with the seat, and the chute opens. And so anyway, the chute opened, and I went down and landed in the swamps here in Florida, and without any further incidents. So
such a terrific life you have.
I was basically the manager of the airspace over the war zone, so I had to coordinate all the activities going on there. And then during Tet, I was there during Tet, and during Tet, one of my units got hit by a 122-millimeter rocket, and I think six out of the crew were killed. But that, and then about a week later, a 122-millimeter rocket hit right outside my barracks and blew my room apart while I was sleeping, and I got a piece of shrapnel right up above my head. And I survived.
Yeah, a lot of miracles during a lifetime, right?
Yeah. And then after that, then my tour in Germany, I was twice I was scheduled for a helicopter trip. I was in command of a whole big NATO unit in command control. I was in charge of all the fixed and the mobile radars in Germany for Central NATO Central World Command. And we were expanding to northern Germany, and so I was scheduled to go on a trip to look at one of the sites that we picked out. And at the last minute, I was called off for another meeting, more important, or whatever, the general called me off to this other meeting, and that helicopter crashed, and all aboard were killed, with all my staff officers and stuff like that. So my job was, of course, notify all the wives and that sort of stuff, people. But and then about a month later, I was scheduled for another helicopter ride from Sembach, where I was stationed, to Ramstein, the air base, so only about a 15-minute flight. And I was called off that one too for a meeting. And then we were, a friend of mine, another colonel, and I was a full colonel, and a friend of mine, but we were driving off the helicopter that I was supposed to be on was taking off, and it blew up on takes. And we ran out to try to send in burnt bodies over the place. I missed that one too. So
when did the war end for you? When did you stop fighting?
When I came out here and became a great grandpa. Now my wife had a stroke, and I was her sole caregiver for 9 years, and so never left her side.
Yeah. Do you have grandchildren?
Grandchildren? I have great grandchildren.
Oh, okay, cool.
Okay, my son and a son and a daughter, and my son and his son, my grandson, and two girls, beautiful girls. They're now 19 and 18 and 18 years old, but I've been with them since basically they were, you know, less than a year old.
Yeah.
Spent a lot of time with them, and they're great athletes and beautiful young ladies. They're really a joy.
That's really cool. That's good that you moved there, that you stay close to the family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, my grandson would have had sons earlier, then I'd probably be a great great grandfather.
Where have you been in Germany? When you said you went to Germany, have you been to Bavaria as well?
To where?
To Bavaria, to southern part of Germany.
Oh, that's mainly where I was. I first came over. I was at Stuttgart.
Okay.
I was at the 7th Corps headquarters, Army headquarters. I was there, the liaison officer to the Corps commander.
Yeah.
Then they asked me to form some troops, and I was moved to Wiesbaden, spent a couple of years in Wiesbaden, and then when the Army took over Wiesbaden and the Air Force moved down to Ramstein, then I was moved down to the Ramstein area. But see, I had units all over Butzbach, I had them all through the southern part of Germany, and that trip I was talking about was to move into northern Germany. I was mostly in Bavaria.
Okay.
Munich, I had a site at Munich, a radar site at Munich.
So it's so great that I was able to talk to you. And
well, it's my pleasure.
It's so cool about Zoom. So we can talk. You're in America, California, I'm in Germany, and we can still chat and talk to each other. That's
great.
That's really great. It's good. Yeah. Good part of being like up to date and to the new world.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends in Europe. In fact, it was last week I had a Zoom with a friend of mine who arranged a Zoom with the Netherlands Air Force.
Oh, so, that's cool.
A group from the Netherlands Air Force and my friend Thijs, who 15 years now.
Yeah. So we keep in touch. And
okay.
Okay,
anytime, just let me know. It's
gonna
be a little advance.
Okay. You have a great day, and thank you so much for the interview.
Okay, you too. I will be leaving now. Okay?
Yeah, have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
You too. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
History Wissen. Heute geht es um den Tiger der Tantra, um Walter Schuck. Walter Schuck wurde am 20. Juli 1920 in Frankenholz im Saarland geboren. Er ist ein deutsches Fliegerass, das von 1937 bis zum Ende des Zweiten Weltkriegs in der deutschen Luftwaffe dient. Schuck flog insgesamt über 500 Kampfeinsätze und schoss dabei 206 Feindesflugzeuge ab. 8 davon während des Fluges mit seiner Messerschmitt 262. Für seine Leistungen erhielt Walter Schuck das Ritterkreuz des Eisernen Kreuzes mit Eichenlaub. Dieses wird nur verliehen, um extreme Tapferkeit auf dem Schlachtfeld oder erfolgreiche militärische Führung zu würdigen. Schuck meldet sich bereits vor Ausbruch des Zweiten Weltkriegs freiwillig zum Dienst bei der Luftwaffe des Dritten Reichs und wird 1937 aufgenommen. Nach der Ausbildung an verschiedenen Piloten- und Jagdpilotenschulen wird Schuck im April 1942 zum Jagdgeschwader 5 an den nördlichsten Abschnitt der Ostfront, an die arktische Front, versetzt. Seinen ersten Luftsieg erringt er am 15. Mai 1942. Das Deutsche Kreuz in Gold wird ihm bereits am 2. August 1943 für 54 Luftsiege verliehen und Schuck wird zum Feldwebel befördert. Am 13. Oktober 1943 kann er an einem einzigen Tag 3 Abschüsse erzielen. Das Ritterkreuz wurde ihm als Oberfeldwebel am 8. April 1944 nach 84 Luftsiegen verliehen. Die Beförderung zum Leutnant erfolgt am 1. Juni 1944. Den 100. Luftsieg konnte er am 15. Mai 1944 erringen. Nach seinem 171. Luftsieg wird Schuck im Kampf verletzt und erhält während seiner Genesungszeit das Ritterkreuz. Als Oberleutnant wird er am 1. Januar 1945 Kapitän der 10. Staffel und im Februar 1945 zum Jagdgeschwader 7 versetzt, wo er auf der Messerschmitt 262 ausgebildet wird. Mit dieser Messerschmitt erringt er weitere 8 Luftsiege und wird Kapitän der 3. Staffel des Jagdgeschwaders 7. Insgesamt erringt er 206 Luftsiege. 30 weitere wurden ihm aber nicht bestätigt. Am 10. April 1945 wird Walter Schucks Maschine getroffen. Der feindliche Pilot ist Joe Peterbus. Schuck kann sich gerade noch rechtzeitig retten und abspringen. Kurz vor Kriegsende gerät er in britische Kriegsgefangenschaft. Walter Schuck schoss während des Zweiten Weltkriegs insgesamt 206 Flugzeuge ab. Deshalb erringt er den Namen Tiger der Tantra. Nach Kriegsende wird er Fluglehrer in der syrischen Luftwaffe. Im Jahre 2005 lernen sich Joe und Walter beide persönlich kennen, woraus sich eine enge Freundschaft entwickelt. Diese hält bis zu Schucks Tod am 27. März 2015 an. Ich bin sehr dankbar, dass mir Joe Peterbus seine Geschichte erzählt hat. Es ist ein großer Zufall, dass genau Joe Walter Schuck diese Fliegerlegende abgeschossen hat. Auch ist es verwunderlich, dass genau Joe am selben Tag auch abgeschossen wird und abspringen muss. Beide Piloten können überleben. Unfassbar ist auch, dass es damals einen Zeugen dieser Luftschlacht gab, der viele Jahre später die Suche nach den beiden Piloten in die Wege geleitet hat und sich Joe und Walter somit treffen konnten. Beide Piloten können sich nach 1945 ein neues Leben aufbauen, haben Kinder und Enkel bekommen. Dies wäre nicht der Fall gewesen, wenn sie an diesem besonderen Tag, am 10. April, das Schicksal anders entschieden hätte. Geschichten wie Joe sind es letztendlich, weshalb ich den Podcast Wunder, Wissen, Weltkrieg genannt habe. All die persönlichen Wunder, die meine Gäste selbst erlebt haben, unterscheiden sich voneinander. Aber sie haben gemeinsam, dass alle somit eine neue Chance bekommen haben, etwas aus ihrem Leben zu machen. Joe wurde kurz nach Kriegsende zurück in die USA geschickt, wo er heiratete und sein Nachkriegsleben beginnt, das schließlich auch in der Luft endet. Joe war sowohl in Korea als auch in Vietnam im Einsatz und war in vielen Funktionen in den USA tätig. Zu Joes Einsatz im Kalten Krieg gehörte auch der Einsatz in höchster Alarmbereitschaft während der Kuba-Krise und ein Auslandseinsatz in Deutschland in den 70er Jahren. Viele Jahre später kehrt Joes Dienst im Zweiten Weltkrieg auf unerwartete Weise zurück, als es ihm gelingt, Kontakt zu dem Piloten aufzunehmen, den er während des Zweiten Weltkriegs abgeschossen hatte. Und die beiden wurden enge Freunde. Wenn auch du dir Joes Geschichte angehört hast, dann bist auch du einer dieser Zeitzeugen, die dazu beitragen, dass die Vergangenheit nicht in Vergessenheit gerät. Somit trägst auch du einen Teil des Feuers weiter. Falls du jemanden kennst, der seine Geschichte gerne mit mir teilen möchte, damit diese viele Zuhörerinnen und Zuhörer bekommt, dann schreib mir gerne eine Nachricht. Ich würde mich auch sehr über eine Empfehlung und eine positive Bewertung freuen. Meine E-Mail-Adresse sowie den Link zu meinem Facebook- und Instagram-Account findest du in den Shownotes. Nächste Woche schon erwartet dich wieder eine brandneue Folge zur Kategorie History Wissen. Ich würde mich freuen, wenn du das nächste Mal auch wieder mit dabei bist, wenn es heißt Wunder, Wissen, Weltkrieg.